Let me start by thanking the organizers very much for this invitation to come and give a talk. And I'll admit, when I first received the invitation, I was a little bit puzzled, because I'm going to be telling you about classical gravity, first of all, almost exclusively. And even worse than that, I'm going to be telling you about perturbative approaches to classical gravity. So I was worried that, you know, we really weren't doing the same sort of thing, that these approaches really weren't fitting in with the theme of your conference very well at all. But then, what do I know? So if you haven't seen this, I recommend you go and follow this link, and it's very amusing. So what are scattering amplitudes, first of all? So we prepare some state in the asymptotic past in some state alpha, and we let it evolve, and it'll interact. Particles perturbatively will scatter off each other, and we'll measure the amplitude for it to emerge looking like some other state beta in the asymptotic future. And these quantities, if we can compute them, they provide a point of contact between what we can compute given some model for what we think the world looks like and what experimentalists actually measure. They're very closely related to cross-sections, branching ratios, things that experimentalists actually deal with. Of course, they encode not just the kinematics of the quantum theory, they really tell you about the dynamics. We're really evolving a state through some space-time. And in gravity, precisely because they're defined in the asymptotic past and asymptotic future, they're really diffeomorphism invariant observables. They really make sense as observables in quantum gravity, at least in the asymptotically flat case. Now, the textbook way of computing scattering amplitudes, as of course you all know, is to draw Feynman diagrams given the available vertices and propagators labeling the particles in the theory. But the trouble is that in precisely the theories that we're most interested in, gauge theories, gravity, this method of computing scattering amplitudes rapidly becomes prohibitively complicated. The number of diagrams you have to compute, even for fairly simple processes, proliferates extremely rapidly as you increase the number of particles in the initial and final states. And because of that, there's been much effort by many people over the past several years now to try to find better ways of thinking about scattering amplitudes, to try to find better ways to compute them. For many people, The motivation, at least initially, for this study was very, very practical. We had this machine, the LHC. We have this machine, the LHC. And if you want to understand the sort of structures that you might see coming out of that, you want to understand what this machine was telling you, you maybe want to search for some new physics, be it the Higgs or something more exotic. The first thing you need to do is understand the background, understand the QCD, the processes that are definitely going to be happening at the LHC, and understand that well. And it's quite clear that a straightforward Feynman diagram approach might be in a bit of trouble with this, with these type of processes. However, although that was the initial motivation, as time went on and people started to look at scattering amplitudes in more and more detail, they realized that they had a huge amount of structure there. They were much, much simpler than you would naively expect from summing up their Feynman diagrams. The poster child for this idea is this amplitude here, MHV, just means that there are two negative helicity gluons in this case, and arbitrarily many positive helicity gluons. And this amplitude was written down over 20 years ago by Park and Taylor, over 30 years ago by Park and Taylor. And it doesn't really matter if you don't follow the notation. The notation's explained here. The important point is simply that that's it. Although that this thing, if you try to compute it by Feynman diagrams, you end up summing more than n factorial Feynman diagrams, the overall answer fits on one line. It's extremely simple. Clearly, there's some property governing the structure of scattering amplitudes that the physics is sort of knows about very directly that our methods of computing the physics don't normally know about directly. Well, as I say, many people have got very fascinated by this, and we've been trying to think about what these structures might be, and there's been all sorts of input from various things that are very pure mathematical to string theory, to twister theory, to Yangians and integrability. Many of these are particularly related to n equals 4 super Young Mills. But today I want to tell you about ones that are related to gravity, and in particular, a rather biased selection of things that I've been perhaps more closely involved with. And that'll concentrate on twister theory and perhaps a little bit of string theory. OK, so many of you here may already know some twisters very well, but just in case, let me give a review. So in the basic case, twister space is complex projective three space. That just means we can describe it by four coordinates, which I'll call Z. And they're defined up to an overall rescaling by some non-zero complex number r. And the statement is that if I give you a line, a holomorphic line x in twister space, that corresponds to some point in space-time. If I give you some other line y in twister space, that's some other point y in space-time, And these two lines in space, these two points in space-time are null separated if and only if this line x intersects this line y. You can, if they do intersect, at least in the Lorentzian case, you can consider this point of intersection here in twister space as representing this light ray that goes between the two points in space-time. Now, one way to test whether these lines, if I give you two lines, one way to test whether they intersect is to pick any two points on the first line, say 1 and 2, and any two points, 3 and 4, on the second line, and just compute the skew symmetric product. Here, epsilon is the four-index epsilon symbol. Compute the skew symmetric product of all of their coordinates, and this thing will vanish if and only if these four points are linearly dependent, which means that those two lines lie in a plane, which means they'll intersect. Okay? So this vanishes if and only if these lines intersect, and so it must be proportional to the Minkowski separation of the two points in space-time, because that also vanishes if the two points were null. But exactly as Lee reminded us, twisters at least initially were important for the conformal structure of space-time. And if this thing doesn't vanish, then its value doesn't mean anything. We can't fix the conformal factor here, precisely because these coordinates were only defined up to an overall rescaling. So if this thing isn't zero, we can always rescale it to be anything you like. It doesn't contain any, it doesn't fix the conformal factor. If we want to describe gravity, we need a little bit more data, because of course we do want to fix the conformal factor, we want to fix a metric. And the right data has been known by Penrose since the 1960s. It's something that he calls the infinity twister. It's just some skew symmetric twister, some skew symmetric two-index tensor on the twister space. And in the simplest case of flat space-time, this object here, again, just represents some line, the infinity twister line. Okay? We can explicit, if I write the coordinates in terms of a pair of spinners, then explicitly it will have this form, and it will correspond to the line where the lambda coordinates vanished with this choice of coordinates. But since it's some line in twister space, that means it's some point in space-time. Which point is it? It's precisely this point here at space-like infinity on the boundary of the Penrose diagram. And correspondingly, any line which intersects this special line, I, corresponds to some point on scry, some point that's null separated from space-like infinity. Now, because I've distinguished this special line, I break conformal invariance. Okay? Initially, we were allowed to rotate all of my four twisters into each other. That gave me an SL4C. Action of SL4C on the complex projective space, which is some complexification of the space-time conformal group. But by fixing this line, I break that down to SL2 cross SL2, the complexification of the Lorentz group. And as well as breaking conformal invariance, it allows us to write a metric. Now, because I can, these angle brackets here are just defined as a contraction of the two twisters with this infinity twister. So this quantity here is now completely independent of the rescalings of any of these coordinates, and so its scale is meaningful, and so it actually defines the Minkowski metric for us. The point I want you to notice is that because this thing is supposed to be a length squared, it's a distance squared, the infinity twister here should carry dimensions of mass. It's appearing in the denominator twice. That's one other way of seeing that the infinity twister breaks conformal invariance. It sets a mass scale. Now, so far, what I've told you about has just been for flat space. We've just got the flat Minkowski metric. If you want to describe gravity on twister space, at least in the self-dual case, this was explained again by Penrose and Ward and Atiyah Hitchin Singer in the mathematical literature. What you're supposed to do is deform the complex structure. The reason is, once you know where the complex structure is on space-time, that tells you where the holomorphic lines are. Once you know where the holomorphic lines are and whether they intersect or not, you know what the space-time conformal structure is. You know where the light cones are in space-time. To deform the complex structure, one way to describe it is just to take the d-bar operator and change it a little bit. Add on a vector field v that changes what we think the d-bar operator is. That will change what we think the holomorphic functions on the twister space are. That will deform the conformal structure. However, if you just deform this by any old vector field v, then it turns out that this deformation will break the infinity twister. The infinity twister, although it was holomorphic with respect to the original d-bar operator, it won't be holomorphic with respect to the new d-bar operator. And that will correspond to turning on a solution of not Einstein gravity, but a solution of conformal gravity, a solution of the Bach equations that is not a solution of the Einstein equations. If you want to stay within the class of solutions of Einstein equations, you can't choose any old v, but instead your v has to be Hamiltonian with respect to the Poisson bracket defined by this infinity twister. Okay. In particular, this little Hamiltonian function H is, at the linearized level, what represents the gravitational radiation, the positive helicity, massless, on-shell, plus 2 helicity field in twister space. Okay. But to do not just infinitesimal deformations, to do finite deformations, once we've got our Hamiltonian vector field, we imagine constructing the twister space by sliding, you know, defining one of these Hamiltonian vector fields on coordinate overlaps and sliding these coordinate overlaps along each other along this vector field. This is what Penrose would call the nonlinear graviton, and it was one of the highlights of classical twister theory. It told us all solutions of self-dual Einstein gravity could be constructed in terms of twister spaces with these particular complex structures. But the major problem, as I'm sure you're aware of twister theory, was that it never really got beyond this self-dual constraint. Now, because the infinity twister is playing such an important role in the geometry of twister space, it shouldn't really surprise you that it also plays an important role in the structure of scattering amplitudes once you write them on twister space. Okay. In particular, you find that if you study an n-particle scattering amplitude at G loops, say, with n plus positive helicity and n minus negative helicity external gravitons, then you'll find that the amplitude on twister space is just a monomial in the infinity twister with this numbers of powers of the infinity twister with upstairs indices, which I'll write sometimes as square brackets, and this number of powers of the infinity twister with downstairs indices, which I'll write as angle brackets. The simplest way to understand these numbers is to remember that, again, in perturbation theory, if we're computing a G-loop n-point Feynman diagram, it will come with a power of the Newton constant, which just depends on how many particles we've got, and depends on the Euler characteristic of the Feynman graph. Okay, so it comes with n plus 2g minus 2 powers of kappa. But kappa is setting a mass scale, and the only thing on twister space that sets a mass scale, the only thing that broke the conformal structure, was the infinity twister. So there's no way you can get this scaling of dimensions, this dimensionful coupling constant, except if on twister space it comes along with an infinity twister. So the total numbers of powers of the infinity twister you have to be n plus 2g minus 2, which is the sum of these two numbers. To see that they separate into two numbers, you need to know that parity will exchange these square brackets with the angle brackets. If you like, it will exchange left and right copies of the Lorentz group. Okay, and because we see this dependence on the infinity twister, once we write the scattering amplitudes on the twister space, the conformal breaking is made explicit. Now, I've said that this program has been going on for many years and that more progress has been made in Yang-Mills. That's largely because we had better data in Yang-Mills. We had more examples of amplitudes that people knew in a nice form that we could start to see the structure in. In gravity, although we've known some amplitudes for many years, the nicest way to write them was only discovered very recently by Andrew Hodges, just in the past year and a half or so. And he showed that this MHV amplitude, again, two negative helicity, arbitrarily many positive helicity gravitons, could be written like this. Once again, the point isn't so much that what are the details of this expression. The point is more just that there's a single expression that I can write in one line. There's clearly a lot of structure there. So what sort of structure do we see? I mean, just getting a nice form for the amplitude is not the end of the story. It's really the beginning of the story. It's the thing we want to mine for more information. What does it tell us? Certainly, it's not telling us that this thing definitely wants to be split apart into billions and billions of Feynman diagrams. So what does it tell us? Okay, so what we see up here, this thing here, is a determinant of a matrix with these entries. The fact that this matrix has got a little pole when lambda I and lambda j come together, this is the skew symmetric product of the two lambdas, so it vanishes if I equals j. This little pole here is suggestive that the elements of this matrix have perhaps come from some sort of propagator on a world sheet. Well, some sort of two-dimensional propagator such that it has a pole when the two particles come together, when the two insertion points come together. Okay. The fact that we take the determinant of this matrix is very suggestive that the operators whose correlation function we're computing, the operators who are giving us these matrix elements, are fermions, because that will give us the anti-symmetry that you find from the determinant. If you exchange rows and columns, it'll correspond to swapping the orders of the fermions. Okay. It's not quite clear at the moment perhaps where this diagonal element comes from, so we have to find that. And the other noticeable thing about this formula is you don't just take the determinant of H. The determinant of H itself would turn out to vanish. H has got co-rank 3. So you're supposed to remove any three rows, say I, J, and K, and any three columns, R, S, T, from this matrix H before computing the determinant, and then you compute the determinant of what's left. That's what sits up in the numerator here. In string theory, maybe in quantum field theory in general, that's reminiscent of having a world sheet that's got some sort of residual symmetry that you need to fix And fixing the residual symmetry leads you to treat certain vertex operators differently from others. That'll be why some states are apparently treated differently from others. But you know, the states corresponding to rows ijk and columns rst are apparently treated differently. But because it's just some way of fixing an overall symmetry, really there is no real difference. It's just a difference in presentation, it is still permutation symmetric under everybody. And clearly, the price we've paid for fixing these rows and columns is these little Jacobians down here. They're obviously something to do with the fact that we're singling out these rows and columns from the matrix. Now, again, you get little Jacobians like this in string theory from ghost insertions corresponding to fixing the special symmetry of the residual symmetry on the world sheet. But for a bosonic symmetry, these Jacobians would usually appear in the numerator. So the fact that they're appearing downstairs in the denominator suggests that this residual symmetry that we're fixing is somehow fermionic. Okay, so the aim of what I was doing was to try to find a world sheet theory that would first of all reproduce that formula for these very special MHV helicity configurations, two negative, arbitrarily many positive, but also generalize it to completely arbitrary helicity configurations to give all classical S matrix elements in gravity. It's going to be based on some sort of string theory. And usually in string theory, we have smooth maps from the world sheet to the target space. So you can, at any given snapshot in time, you can decompose you have some wobbly world sheet, you decompose it into Fourier modes, and those Fourier modes all correspond to higher towers of string states, new alpha prime excitations of the string. You have an infinite tower of those things. But they all enter at some scale set by the scale of the Fourier expansion, the alpha prime, the string tension. The twister string that we've got is going to be different. It's not going to be able to oscillate because its tension is infinite. Okay, so we're not going to have arbitrary smooth maps, wobbly maps, if you like, into twister space. Instead, it's going to have infinite tension, so it's going to wrap around non-contractible cycles extraordinarily tightly, infinitely tightly. So, of course, strings can always wrap around, they're extended objects, they can always wrap around cycles if we have them in the space-time. But normally, if we're just talking about string theory in flat space, there are no interesting cycles to wrap. In twister space, there are plenty of interesting cycles to wrap. There's moduli spaces for them. This no longer wants to work. Okay. So, as I've said, the string theory I'm going to construct is going to be based on holomorphic maps to twister space, not smooth maps. Of course, it's very much in the philosophy of Penrose that things should be holomorphic in twister space. And the simplest way to do that is just to have some field Y which acts as a Lagrange multiplier saying that Z, a field on the string, should just be holomorphic, describing a holomorphic map to twister space. But remember, the Zs were only defined up to an overall rescaling, and so we handle that by including by saying that they're charged under some world sheet gauge field that just rescales the Zs. And so this is our basic thing. This is just going to describe, Z is just going to describe a holomorphic map from sigma into twister space. But we need to add some extra fields to this model. These extra fields, they need to introduce the infinity twister. We saw that was very important. We need to somehow use them. Correlation functions of these extra fields somehow have to provide that complicated looking matrix for us, that complicated looking determinant. And there may be various other jobs such as canceling anomalies that these extra fields also have to do. The right way to do it is probably not immediately obvious. It certainly wasn't immediately obvious to me. But what turned out to work was to think of extending the world sheet not just being some Riemann surface, but giving it two fermionic directions on the world sheet. So as well as a bosonic coordinate x on sigma, we also have two fermionic coordinates theta. So little a here runs from 1 to 2. And vector fields pointing in these theta directions, because they can also depend on theta, they obey some algebra, and the algebra turns out to be SL1/2. This is some world sheet superalgebra. It's got four bosonic and four fermionic generators. And the only thing to notice is that the maximal bosonic part of this algebra is GL2R. If you like, you can think of that as just rotating and rescaling these theta coordinates. And sitting inside this GL2, there's a GL1, which we're going to identify with that GL1, that rescaling of the target space coordinates. Okay. So then the fields in the theory are extremely simple. There's a matter field. Everything depends on these super coordinates on the world sheet. So everything has some expansion in terms of thetas. The matter field, the highest component just corresponds to which corresponds to the map to twister space. And then they've got some partners, and at the bottom, we've got this Lagrange multiplier field that was conjugate to Z. Then there are some ghosts, some anti-ghosts, which are associated with the supersymmetries that we've got on the world sheet. I said there was a symmetry SL1/2. There's typically a gauge field. That's a local symmetry. We can choose a gauge where that gauge field vanishes. And if you do it, the action looks extremely simple. And you know, it's basically just a first order action for the supermultiplet Z, and then a bilinear first order action for the anti-ghost and the ghost, which is the usual sort of form of a ghost-anti-ghost action in an axial type of gauge. And the BST operator looks like this, a standard form for a BST operator in the gauge theory. The important point is that these angle brackets here, remember, they denoted the infinity twister. So the BRST operator in this theory knows about the infinity twister. That's why this theory will break conformal invariance, as opposed to other twister string theories that have been computed a decade ago by Witten and Berkowitz, which didn't know about the infinity twister. If they, string theories almost always, well, describe gravity in the closed string sector. So if there was ever any way of any gravity arising in the Berkowitz-Witten twister string, because it didn't know about the infinity twister, the type of gravity it was going to get was always going to be conformal gravity. Indeed, that's exactly what happened, and that's a sick theory. That's not a unitary theory, as far as anyone knows. This theory is going to be different because it's BRST operator, and so all the states do know about the infinity twister. The theory I wrote down is a chiral gauge theory. On the kinetic operators on the world sheet were always D bar operators, not D operators. That's a slightly dangerous thing to do in the context of a gauge theory. There are plenty of anomalies that are there to bite you if you have chiral matter in a gauge theory. And you have to check that those anomalies cancel. I won't go through the details of the calculations. It's a straightforward calculation, particularly in two dimensions. But you can check that when n equals 8, so when the target space has exactly n equals 8 supersymmetry, all of these anomalies and various others I haven't written down all cancel. That's the real reason that we want to describe, that I have to describe n equals 8 supergravity using this way rather than any other type of supergravity, at least in the first instance. The anomalies tell me that n has to be 8. Okay. Cancelling the anomalies really means the path integral over the non-zero modes of the fields makes sense, but there are also some zero modes. And typically, it's the positively charged fields that have zero modes, positively charged under rescalings in twister space. Of course, Z itself had positive charge, because that rescales under rescaling the twisters. And you can count how many zero modes, at least generically, if the world sheet is a holomorphic map of degree D on a genus G Riemann surface, you can check that generically Z has this many zero modes, and that will correspond at the end of the day to being some constraint between the degree of the map and the helicity configuration. So as in the Berkowitz-Witten twister string, exactly what our curve looks like in twister space, whether it's just a point or a straight line or a conic or something more wiggly, will tell us the allowed helicity configurations that we're scattering on this curve. Some of the ghosts have also got some zero modes. The ghosts that I call gamma have some zero modes, and fixing this zero modes, it turns out that's exactly related to fixing the residual symmetry that we said that we expected our world sheet to have that corresponded to removing these rows and columns. The number of zero modes the gamma has corresponds to exactly the number of rows and columns you're supposed to remove from that Hodges matrix that I showed you before. There are also some zero modes of an anti-ghost saying that there are some fermionic moduli, and that corresponds to the number of angle bracket type of infinity twisters we have. Let me skip this transparency. We then have to write down some vertex operators. The simplest vertex operators are really inserted at a point, and because the ghost gamma had positive charge, that had charge 1, this is a more or less standard form of the vertex operator in the RNS string. It involves a delta function of gamma. That pins down gamma at certain insertion points. That's what fixes the residual symmetry. But because gamma has got charge 1, delta of gamma has got charge minus 1, and so delta 2 of gamma has got charge minus 2. And so to get a gauge invariant, an uncharged vertex operator, we need to multiply it by some function of the matter field that's got charge plus 2 to balance the charge. That turns out to be exactly that same little Hamiltonian function, the thing that I said, according to Penrose, represents a linearized positive helicity graviton. It's exactly the same wave function that we saw in our Hamiltonian vector fields that has to appear in the matter vertex operators of this string theory. There's some descent procedure that takes you between vertex operators inserted at a point and vertex operators that are integrated over the world sheet. And if you just follow this, you'll find again that you get some vertex operator that is exactly the Hamiltonian vector field corresponding to H. Remember, Y was canonically conjugate to Z, so Y is like d by dz, and so this is a sort of Hamiltonian vector field. And then there's some sort of fermionic completion. These fermions that we get, which were sitting in the matter, is exactly going to be their correlation functions that gave us those little propagators, that gave us those elements of the of that Hodges matrix. There are some picture-changing operators associated with, well, I said the world sheet has got some sort of superstructure. It turns out there's a moduli space of those superstructures, and although I can't really explain the details here, the picture-changing operators, they emerge naturally from the formalism, and they're just some way of choosing a slice of this fermionic moduli space over which to integrate. So that's the claim. The claim is that according to this string theory, all we do is we insert our vertex operators, some fixed to absorb the residual symmetries, some integrated, as many as you like of the integrated ones, and then some picture-changing operators, again, to absorb the fermionic symmetries, the fermionic moduli. And all the dependence on the infinity twister lies in these vertex operators. If it's a square bracket infinity twister, or if it's an angle bracket infinity twister, so the infinity twister downstairs, it lies in these picture changing operators. So the claim is to compute any tree level scattering amplitude in n equals 8 supergravity, you evaluate this path integral on the world sheet of the string. So let's look at the pieces separately. It turns out they do factorize. You can evaluate the correlators separately. First of all, let's look at the picture changing operators. That turns out to be, although I haven't really explained where they come from, the evaluation of them turns out to be very interesting and very easy, because it's a general statement in string theory that if you move the insertion of a picture changing operator, you move it around on the world sheet, that's a BRST exact thing to do, so that the answer for the picture changing correlator really can't depend on the location of where you've put them on the world sheet. And indeed, that turns out to be true. You can explicitly calculate this correlation function. The picture changing operators only knew about lambda, and what you get turns out, as Freddy Cacciaso first pointed out, it turns out to be the resultant of the lambda components of the map. Let me just remind you a little bit about the resultants. What a resultant is, kind of a generalization of a discriminant. A discriminant, if you hand me a polynomial, say a quadratic, a discriminant is a further polynomial I'll construct out of the coefficients of your polynomial, b squared minus 4ac, and my discriminant will vanish if and only if your polynomial has a double root, has a repeated root. For resultants, resultants are a generalization in that now you hand me two polynomials. In this case, the two polynomials are the two components of lambda. So because lambda is a holomorphic map to twister space, that just means essentially it's polynomial on the world sheet. Lambda's got two components, so the two components define two polynomials. And resultants, once you give me these two polynomials, I'll construct some further polynomial out of the coefficients of your polynomials with the property that my resultant polynomial will vanish if your two polynomials have a simultaneous root. Okay? So in our context, having a simultaneous root means that there's some point on the world sheet that obeys both lambdas evaluated at that point as zero. That's our simultaneous root. Okay? And the resultant has the property that it vanishes if and only this is true for some point on the world sheet. But what is this place in twister space? What does it mean to say both lambdas are zero? Well, the line lambda equals zero was exactly this line at infinity. So the correlation function of these operators is just telling you that it gives you zero if any point on the world sheet intersects the line at infinity. Or in other words, it's saying that really the world sheet just maps to the inside of twister space once you've removed this line. Okay? It really maps to the non-compact twister space, not to the CP3. The remaining correlation function, I won't go through the details, but it precisely gives you some sort of generalization of the Hodges matrix. So we get some determinant of an object here, which has got some sort of propagator. These things turn into lambda tildes on momentum space. This just reproduces exactly the Hodges matrix in the case of MHV, but it generalizes it to arbitrary MHV, and you can see that we remove different numbers of rows and columns depending on exactly what the degree D of the map is, or in other words, exactly what the helicity configuration of the external states are. There's some basis of zero MOS which provide us with the Jacobians, rather like we saw in the original Hodges matrix. And exactly which rows and columns are removed from this matrix just corresponds to which operators we decided to treat as fixed vertex operators as opposed to integrated ones. But that was just fixing some residual symmetry. So it's completely permutation invariant, completely invariant under your choice of which rows and columns to single out that way. Now, okay, that's nice. We've reproduced this formula. But still, what does it mean? Right? Is it just some big complicated determinant? What's going on? Well, the best way to think is, instead of computing this rather complicated correlation function with lots and lots and lots of vertex operators inserted, what we should do is, whenever you have an integrated vertex operator in quantum field theory, in string theory also, but more generally in quantum field theory, you should always really think of it as a little deformation of the action. Right? It's something that you've imagined infinitesimally deforming the action, so to first order it just brings down this integrated vertex operator. So in our case, if we add this integrated vertex operator onto the action, then, as well as the original y d bar z, which was just the holomorphic term, we now get this Hamiltonian vector field also gets added on to the y d bar z, and of course there's some correction to the fermionic states as well. But what's this saying? This is now saying that y is no longer a Lagrange multiplier telling you that z is holomorphic with respect to the original d bar operator, but rather z has to be holomorphic with respect to the deformed d bar operator obtained by deforming the complex structure along this Hamiltonian vector field. Okay, the path integral over y now imposes this new constraint on z, not the basic one. Okay. So, well, again, I won't go through the details, but if we were to try to find at least locally some coordinates that are just straightforwardly holomorphic rather than holomorphic with respect to this deformed complex structure, then if we re-expand the path integral, this very simple path integral that just involved a few vertex operators but was working in a sort of nonlinear action, if you re-expand that path integral, which is very easy to compute, then you find that you regenerate, essentially as a Jacobian, you regenerate this whole set of determinants. In other words, what it's telling you is that all the insertion points of vertex operators on your world sheet curve, remember, all these vertex operators just corresponded to little Hamiltonian vector fields. They're just little arrows pointing, as it happens, normal to the world sheet. And so they're just telling you little ways to pull your curve so that it doesn't look like a holomorphic curve with respect to the original complex structure that you thought like. But it's a curve without any points on it that corresponds to a holomorphic curve in the nonlinear graviton conformal structure, in the deformed complex structure. So combining all the pieces, the only thing that scattering amplitudes are in this picture is it says that all tree amplitudes in n equals 8 supergravity live on degree d curves in twister space, but it's not the original twister space, it's not the flat twister space, it's really the nonlinear graviton, it's really the deformed twister space, it's got this new complex structure, and infinity has been removed, it's the non-complex. So it just lives on a degree d curve in a nonlinear graviton, is the simplest way to say. These things just represent our choice of external wave functions. This formula is true. It agrees with the formula that I found together with Freddy Cacciazzo last year. I've derived it here from a string theory as opposed to just writing it down, which is what Freddy and I did. But the reason we know it's true is essentially because, well, there are various tests you can do to amplitudes to check that they're true. The most powerful one is really to check that it factorizes in all the right ways. So Feynman diagrams have got singularities coming from their propagators. If you cut one of these propagators, then the residue of that propagator is the product of the two subamplitudes that you get on either side. And in twister space, what that means is that this amplitude is holomorphic as we vary the external twister, except in configurations on the boundary of the moduli space where this map to twister space degenerates into a nodal curve, summed over all the ways it might degenerate. So all the ways of distributing these points on either side and integrated over where the node corresponds to. That's really just the normal statement of factorization in quantum field theory rewritten in twister space. And you can check that the formula that I wrote on the previous transparency really obeys that, right? In particular, when the curve turns into a nodal curve, when you go to the boundary of the moduli space, these big determinants just factorize. They become block diagonal, and they factorize into products of smaller determinants. We've done various other checks, and together these checks amount to just a proof that this is the classical S matrix, perturbative S matrix of n equals 8 supergravity. Okay, let me conclude. So, I've provided you, described in very brief outline, a twister string theory. It's a holomorphic twister string theory. Its spectrum corresponds not to an infinite tower of states, but just to n equals 8 supergravity in four dimensions. More than that, once you compute its world sheet correlation functions, here at genus zero, we get all scattering amplitudes, all perturbative scattering amplitudes in n equals 8 supergravity. So it really does seem to correspond to gravity. It has very natural geometry. It's not doing this in some mysterious way and just generating complicated formula. It's really making contact with what Penrose wanted to say about gravity using twisters, at least the self-dual part. And it goes beyond what Penrose did, because although the background is only self-dual, the degree of the curve that we're looking at in twister space, we're no longer just looking at points in twister space, we're no longer looking, as it were, locally in twister space. The fact that we're looking at these higher degree curves is giving us, at least perturbatively, all the non-self-dual corrections. It's completing it, at least in this S-matrix sense, to all of Einstein gravity in this asymptotically flat perturbative regime. Okay, there are many, many open questions which I probably won't go through. The most important, from my point of view, is to understand how this story carries on to higher genus. I told you that the anomalies cancelled at higher genus. We would expect to get quantum corrections as usual in string theory from looking at higher genus curves. I'm in the middle of that calculation now. Let me stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. A few years ago, I happened to be invited to a string conference, and so I think I know how you feel. But I also now understand better the lost eyes of many people in the audience when I was speaking.
So my lights are very bright, so if you look lost, I couldn't see.
Yeah, no. So you, of course, you. My question is about the background of this, because you of course give a number of things for granted, for assumed, for known. Maybe so for me or some other people in the audience are less. Let me ask a very simple question. You about the sense of all this. You started off by saying in gauge theories and in gravity, we somehow at some point it was discovered this simplification when many Feynman graphs are. And then you say, look, this can be understood and can be seen, if I understand it overall, in this case in which n equal 8 supergravity amplitude can be recovered to this extent from a string twister theory. This is, and concretely, for what I understand, this is very beautiful the way this is coming out. Now, the question is that, is this beauty, this effectiveness, it depends on what? It depends on the specificity of a supergravity theory, depends on supersymmetry, depends on the, n equal 8 supergravity is a very particular theory, in a sense is a very simple theory, understand, in a sense is a very, so, but is also, I mean, it's not the theory of our world. I mean, there's no low energy supersymmetry in our world, we know. So is this to be understood as, look, there are this beautiful structure, maybe around that we can understand something realistic for the world? Is this to be understood, no, look, this is probably very general and can also be applied to an actual theory that describes, what is the,
okay,
what's
so,
the logic?
So my
second question is that, do I
really
have
the
such
one
a
first and then,
bad
and then
Italian accent as, do I really have such a bad Italian accent?
No.
As in the...
Oh, I apologize. It wasn't my video.
Okay.
Everything I've spoken about is just the classical S matrix. And so, classically, if you restrict your, of course, n equals 8 supergravity has not just the positive and negative velocity gravitons on shell, but a whole load of junk in the middle. Classically, if you just choose to scatter only positive and negative velocity gravitons, you know, the same stuff that's there in GR and nothing else, the amplitudes you get are identical to those in n equals 8 supergravity. So if I just take this formula exactly as I've written it, and I just say that my external, I said there was some dependence on some external wave functions here, I choose these to correspond to gravitons, not to supergravitons. Those are the amplitudes in GR. Okay. Now, how can, of course, if I wanted to scatter, that's very simple to understand. The reason is that all the other states carry some extra quantum numbers. There's some extra symmetry, and R-symmetry, people call it, in the extra states. And since that's a symmetry, you can't just produce one of these particles at any vertex in the Feynman graph. You have to at least pair produce them. Okay. Those states can't propagate, because if they did, you had to pair produce them. I told you that our external states are all gravitons. We chose that, so they don't go out to the external weight. So somehow this pair has to come together, but then we're not talking about a tree graph anymore. That same argument tells you, of course, that at loops it will be very different. Of course, we know this. Now, is there some way of perhaps restricting this string theory so that even as a string theory, it still makes sense as n equals 0? Maybe. One way to do it would be to take these fermionic directions in the target space and impose, as well as the overall scaling with respect to CP38, give them their own private scaling where they rescale by an eighth root of unity. Okay. And then the point is that you can't have any subset of them, because any subset will have some non-zero charge under this eighth root of unity scaling. So either you have none of these fermions or you have all of them, and that will correspond to the two helicity graviton states. So that's the sort of constraint you might try to imagine imposing on the string theory. But from this point of view, it's a further constraint, and so it's a little bit more difficult. There are more things to check. My belief has also been this, there has been some recent interest in whether n equals 8 supergravity might be perturbatively finite or not. The question, it turned out, has not been completely resolved. I think my inclination is that it's probably not, but it's not clear. It's not been settled. So if you think that string theory gives you finite, at least perturbatively finite theories, then if you want there to be a string theory for some version of gravity in four dimensions, which one's it going to be? The simplest answer is going to be n equals 8 supergravity. That's the one that sort of stands the best chance of being finite. But really, the point was more just that, scattering amplitudes, even at loop level, they do live. If you rewrite them in twister space, compute them any way you like, I don't care. Compute them any way you like, and then rewrite them in these twister variables. You'll find that they live on algebraic curves. That calls out for an explanation. Why do they do that? What's it got to do? And that was the basis of looking for this string theory.
I have a question about your formula. Your formula is integral over embeddings of all shit into the twister
holomorphic
space.
Ones, yes.
Is it actually an integral, or the wave functions that you have to insert kill the integral completely?
If you choose the wave functions to be momentum eigenstates or twist eigenstates so that they're localized at points, then they kill them, yeah. Yeah, so actually in twister space, you can think that the amplitude, if you ask to scatter twister eigenstates, that it's sort of distributional. They overkill them. You're left with some delta functions. And really, geometrically, all it means is that you've got some world sheet. It's constrained to be a holomorphic map into the target space, so you have these very nice curves. But you've also picked some points in the target space, and the claim is that the amplitude is zero unless those points just happen to lie on one of these curves.
Yeah, just a comment. The video that you didn't show, for people who haven't seen it, is entitled "It's the Same Damn Thing."
Yes, yes.
And I think that's a challenge for all of us.
I would love that to be true.
just a question, a general question. Since the two talks are about somehow twisters, and in your talk, I mean, this is a pretty remarkable formula. I hope everybody appreciates what it is that, now we have an exact formula for the Hamilton-Jacobi functional of usual gravity, right? Expanded, but, to all order. And that's something we didn't know before. And yeah. It's a extremely important new piece of data. And what's interesting is that this Hamilton-Jacobi functional now is parametrized in terms of twister. But the previous talk was, well, he wanted to compute quantum amplitudes, which are also, parametrized by boundary states, which are also labeled by some ensemble of twisters. So maybe, in fact, I'm having a dream that there's a way to merge these two things, that in some sense, there's some relationship between this way of parametrizing the states as asymptotic states and, the other way of parametrizing states as some kind of slice states in twister space. Of course, these other ones are related to some kind of discrete geometries, but maybe, I don't know, did you think about some kind of geometrical interpretation, some kind of polyhedral interpretation of this twister geometry? Even if they live at infinity, they might, be represented. I know it's far-fetched, and it's a question for both speakers, in fact.
I've come from such a different background that I can't say. But the only thing I would perhaps say is that in Simone's talk, he was saying that the twisters he tended to use were hypersurface twisters. So one of the things Penrose did a long time ago to try to get beyond this restriction to self-dual geometries was to study a twister space not defined globally for the space-time, but just with respect to some hypersurface. And that seemed to be, from what I understood of Simone's talk, that was how they were cropping up there. As a special case of these hypersurface twisters, you can take this this Cauchy surface asymptotically just to be null infinity. If there's a relation, I would think it goes via that, but I can't say anything definite at the moment, I'm afraid.
Sorry. So this is a comment in the same direction, which is that you showed us that a certain determinant was a sum of trees, which is what happens in tree matrix theorems also. So yes. Would you have a discretized interpretation of this relation?
Ah, wonderful. As a comment on the matrix tree theorem, yes, absolutely. The fact that the determinants with this particular form where the diagonal elements are sums of the off-diagonal elements, that happens. The real reason it happens here is because there's this world sheet supersymmetry. So you can draw the same graphs on the world sheet now for fermions or bosons running in the loops, and they just cancel by the usual reasons of supersymmetry. So all you're left with is the trees, and that's why this determinant, it's a determinant because it's a correlation function of fermions, and it's the sum of trees because there's some supersymmetry that cancels all the loops. Then you said something more interesting, which I didn't catch. I'm not sure. That would be saying that the discretization that Laurent was talking about is related to the discretization in terms of the number of particles that I'm talking about. The vertices in the trees would be the number of particles for me. I haven't thought along those lines. It sounds interesting.
Just a quick question, if I can also, if we still have time. You stressed a lot how the infinity twister plays a key role in breaking the conformal invariance, and yes. I was, which is very nice, but I was wondering in more general situations, like if you have a solution of generativity which is not asymptotically flat, I don't know, Gödel rotating universe, or if space-time is compact,
okay.
Then we still need to break conformal invariance to get GR.
I was interested in scattering amplitudes, so I was by definition interested in asymptotic flat. And there, this infinity twister took this very special form. I didn't really emphasize it, but it's true. If you look in the back of volume 2 of Penrose and Rindler, you'll find that there are infinity twisters written out for lots and lots of different types of space-times, in particular any conformally flat one. So if you want to describe something with a cosmological constant, it turns out you turn on some piece proportional to the cosmological constant down here. Penrose also gives you bang and crunch twister, infinity twisters for Friedman, Roberts, and Walker spacetimes. There are various ones in there. It would be fun to try to play, and I have tried to play with these formula by using some sort of more general type of infinity twister. So far, I haven't had any success doing that. You have to think about what observables you're trying to calculate in those spaces, first of all.
Let us thank the speaker again.